We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time she will choose life, but they can't do it without your help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside them. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us on today's edition of The Core here on AFR. Walker Wildman here with you. The show is hosted each week by myself and Rick Green. Once again, it's good to be with you today on the program. As a reminder to those of you who listen loyally to the AFR and those of you maybe who are new, we would greatly appreciate it if you subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's on Apple device, Spotify, Amazon, wherever you download and subscribe to podcasts, we would greatly appreciate it if you subscribe to this program. And we upload the show in the form of a podcast each and every afternoon wherever you listen to podcasts. Just type in At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green and click the subscribe or the follow button, and it will be queued up in your library. Every new episode will be ready to go in your library each and every day. Let's turn our attention to the scripture. Acts chapter 14 is where we have been this week. Acts chapter 14. Now it happened in Iconium that they went together to the synagogue of the Jews, and so spoke that a great multitude of both the Jews and the Greeks believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren. Therefore they stayed there a long time, speaking boldly in the Lord, who was bearing witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. But the multitude of the city was divided, part sided with the Jews and part sided with the apostles. And when a violent attempt was made by both the Gentiles and the Jews with their rulers to abuse and stone them, they became aware of it and fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and to the surrounding region. And they were preaching the gospel there. And so what I want to draw away from this passage today in Acts chapter 14, verses 1 through 7, is that even when the early apostles and when the early church was facing severe persecution, being run out of cities, death threats upon them, they were found at the next location preaching the gospel there. That's a quote from Acts chapter 14, verse 7. So they were undeterred, remaining faithful to preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's Acts chapter 14, verses 1 through 7. Well, today, Dr. Anthony Fauci is testifying, yet not testifying, before the U.S. Senate. This is before Senator Rand Paul's committee, and this has been quite a fiasco. And just to bring about a brief history lesson for you, Anthony Fauci was the trusted source of all things COVID during the first Trump administration following the onset of the COVID pandemic. And everybody looked at what does Dr. Fauci say? What does Anthony Fauci say? And it was somewhat this godlike approach to Dr. Fauci, very concerning. And he somewhat was the leader of the COVID response. I mean, President Trump put him up at the podium. Vice President Pence basically deferred to Dr. Fauci on everything. And Anthony Fauci brought us a lot of the horror that we remember from COVID was brought to you by Dr. Fauci, including the lockdowns and the mask wearing and the social distancing, et cetera, and not to mention the COVID shots, which caused a lot of damage and failed to be effective. And so that's the 60-second backgrounder on Anthony Fauci. Well, he's testifying before Congress about his personal diary and his note-taking during the COVID pandemic and all of this that has since become public record. And so let's break down this testimony. The first thing to note is that Dr. Fauci wouldn't answer any questions. He did the Lois Lerner opening statement, and then after that he said, oh, I'm pleading the fifth. Oh, I don't want to talk about it. I'm pleading the fifth. Very interesting situation. And him pleading the fifth tells you all you need to know. I mean, he's been pardoned by President Biden. And for what? What's he being pardoned for? Well, that's unclear. I don't know why you need a pardon if you didn't do anything wrong. But Dr. Fauci's been pardoned by Biden. So his attorneys told him plead the fifth on everything. So Dr. Fauci wouldn't answer anything. Let's listen to clip one. This is Anthony Fauci pleading the fifth on literally every question. Clip one.
Mr. Fauci, do you know who David Shertler is?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. What does the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution say?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution.
No, I'm just asking you what it says.
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
Oh, okay. So this is how this is going to go. Folks, the only, you ask me, you know, what's the solution here? What do we do with this guy? Right. I mean, that ultimately he's coming here before the Senate, not answering the questions. What do you do with this? All right. A couple things. First off, this guy should have been fired a long, long time ago. I mean, he should have been let go from NIH a long, long time ago during the first Trump administration. The fact that Fauci lingered on as long as he did in the Trump administration is an absolute travesty. He should have never been allowed to linger as long as he did. And I put the responsibility, folks, we can talk about how bad Fauci is, and that cup holds water. But President Trump and Vice President Pence and Dr. Deborah Birx, all of these folks, they just said, yeah, whatever Fauci says. And they gave him the podium at the White House press briefing room every day, day in, day out, for months. Okay? So President Trump and Vice President Pence bear some responsibility on this. And Vice President Pence, by the way, was the go-to executive on the whole COVID task force response. Now, to President Trump's defense, President Trump became skeptical of Fauci very early on. It wasn't months into the pandemic where President Trump brought Deborah Birx and Fauci to the Oval Office and just tore them a new one. So, and said, y'all have handled this wrong. This is a disaster. So President Trump usually comes around to his senses and usually has very good judgment in due time. But Fauci was given that White House podium for way too long. But nonetheless, what do you do with this? Well, the fact of the matter is that there was so much done wrong with COVID, and I'm not a big fan of these like confession sessions or, you know, this time where you just moan and groan about the past. And I'm not trying to be, you know, play the victim here. But let me just tell you that there was so much harm done during the COVID era. It would take us a long time. It would take us so long to talk about it and to make peace with it. I mean, when I started thinking about this morning, getting ready for the show, my emotions got stirred up. I got angry again, and I thought, oh, I can't believe they did that. I can't believe that they locked elderly people in the nursing homes and told them that their family can't come see them when they're dying. Oh, think about the things that we did as a society. And then I watched the video of the kid having a mask put, this two-year-old's having a mask put on them at childcare, at daycare, at school. What on this earth were we thinking? And then I think about the COVID shots and how, you know, we were told if you don't get the COVID shot, you don't care about people and you're going to kill people and shame on you. And then, you know, the comedians were talking about how, yeah, you know, if those anti-vaxxers die, I wouldn't shed a tear. Oh, wow. That's where we are. And so, and that's just, I barely even touched the surface right there. And then you've got the whole pharmaceutical side of this and the billions of dollars that was flowing around with these pharmaceutical companies. You know, we were told to stay home, social distancing, put your mask on. How dare you? Anybody who didn't say yes, sir, got shamed publicly and otherwise. People lost their jobs. Military members got dishonorably discharged over this stuff. Churches shut down. I mean, the list goes on. Once I said, like I said, we could spend a long time on this.
You know, if I may, the irony of all this is he gets to exercise his constitutional right to plead the fifth.
Yeah.
But yet we couldn't use our God-ordained rights to make choices we wanted to without being shamed, lambasted, and what have you.
Yes.
That's the irony, and that it's just not
right. Yeah, he taught submission, and he himself isn't willing to submit.
Amen.
To a duly elected Congress. That's the moral of the story. And Anthony Fauci himself wasn't elected to his position at NIH. So he's an unelected bureaucrat. He was an unelected bureaucrat expecting all of us to say yes, sir, to Dr. Fauci. And here you have a duly elected U.S. Senate of which he won't answer their questions. To Bobby's point, that is the ultimate irony. But we need there is nothing that the people who push this evil can do to quote unquote make up from the sins of the past. And that's not what I'm here for. To expect to be, you know, to expect restitution for everyone. That's not even possible here because there was so much wrong done. But at a minimum, for the sake of peace of mind, there needs to be some public confessions here. There needs to be public confessions by every official, starting with President Trump, Vice President Vance, and everyone in between that oversaw this Operation Warp Speed and this disastrous COVID response. They just need to own up to it. They just need to own up to it. And this doesn't have to be some long, drawn-out thing. This doesn't end your political career. You know, this doesn't have to be more than simply acknowledging that the way we handled that was wrong. We shouldn't have locked elderly people in the nursing homes. We shouldn't have told people they can't have a funeral. We shouldn't have told kids that you got to wear a mask. The three-year-old's got to wear a mask. And if you don't get the shot, you're going to kill people. They just need to say, we shouldn't have done that. This was just wrong. And there has been some of that. There's been some public officials here and there that have said, look, we handled this thing wrong, and I was wrong about it. We shouldn't have approached it this way. If I could go back, I would never do that again. But we just got to have more of that because I feel as though that thing just got swept under the rug. I mean, that was such a horror story. That was such a traumatic experience for everyone that nobody wants to go back. Like, nobody wants to talk about it because it brings back terrible memories. But I think part of the healing process in this country, and part of the healing process is individuals, and to make sure we do not repeat the mistakes of the past, I think we've got to spend some time reflecting and confessing and admitting that the way we handled that COVID thing was an unmitigated disaster. And I'll admit, there's some of it I bought into, you know. I wasn't a big fan of the mask from day one because it was dehumanizing. But for a while I thought, well, maybe the lockdowns do work. I mean, if these shots do work, that would be phenomenal, you know? And so the messaging was so compelling. It was so emotional. It was so convicting, so compelling that everybody just fell in line. And there were some holdouts. I remember some people early on that were like, yeah, this doesn't pass the smell test. I'm not doing it. I'm not putting on the mask. I'm not taking the shot. I'm not staying 6 feet apart. There were some people in the early days and weeks that were like, nope, not doing it. And turns out they were right. They had some profound wisdom in their instincts there. But Anthony Fauci won't answer questions before the Senate. He'll write a book. He'll go on television and have people fawn over him, and he'll want to tell the rest of the world what they should be doing, how they should be living. But answering questions before a duly elected U.S. Senate through a subpoena process, Anthony Fauci's too good to do it. Too good to participate. All right, folks, we'll be back in just a few minutes.
America's 250th birthday. It's a great excuse to have some extra cake and ice cream, but we can help your celebration go well beyond that. Show your patriotism with America 250 apparel that will become a memento of this special year. We also have special episodes on AFA Stream to help underscore that America is a Christian nation and help you find God in the Constitution. Find all of this and more in one place. afa.net/topics/250.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to be with you today on the program. We've got the video up on Facebook, At the Core on Facebook, also on all the AFR handles on social media, and at stream.afa.net. Well, I want to welcome our next guest that we have with us, Mike Mazie. He's running for governor in the state of Oklahoma and has a runoff coming up here in about 3 to 4 weeks on the 25th of August. And he's with us now to talk about his run for governor. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Walker. Thanks for being a true conservative.
Amen. Appreciate that. Well, we've got a lot of listeners in the Sooner State, a lot of radio stations throughout Oklahoma. So you're talking to a very friendly audience there. But tell us about your run for governor. What's made you make this decision, and then some of the major issues you plan to address as governor?
Well, Walker, we really found that the people of Oklahoma were worrying about headquarters moving to the no-income tax state of Texas and seniors being terrified that they're going to lose their homes because of skyrocketing property taxes. And then we ranked 49th in reading outcomes. So I'm a financial planner. I do know how to build a plan. So I built a plan to make Oklahoma a no-income tax state, abolish property taxes for seniors and veterans, launch a massive statewide literacy program so we get our kids reading at grade level. And then we've also got a plan to deal with this mess of Chinese foreign adversary-owned land that's kind of run amok in the state of Oklahoma.
The property taxes should resonate with everyone, hopefully. Most people are property owners, not all, but most. The states like Florida, well, Florida's trying to move away from this, but Texas, the states that are trying to move away from property taxes are going to lead the way. It's similar with getting away with the income tax. It just opens the door up for businesses and hardworking people to move into a state. What's the plan on that? I mean, what kind of reception would you get before the legislature, and has this worked with other states as far as getting rid of the property tax?
Well, I want Oklahoma to be the first state in the country to abolish property taxes for seniors and veterans. And I crunched the numbers, Walker. And in Oklahoma, for our counties, which is where property tax revenue goes, we're not like Texas, where property tax revenue goes to the state. Tax collections for seniors 65 and older is only 10% of the property tax base. And property tax collections for most counties have been growing 5, 6, 7% per year. So my plan phases the property tax collections for seniors on their homes over, say, a 3-year period. And by doing it that way, there's still a net gain of property tax collections of about 3% per year. So core essential services and bond payments for schools will be just fine. And needless to say, our seniors across the state just love this plan, and we're excited to work on it next year with the Oklahoma legislature.
You know, the property tax I don't like it. I think it's somewhat unconstitutional. It, for the reason that if you have to pay perpetual taxes forever on your property, then you really don't own it. You're a joint owner with the state as long as you send them, you know, some money every year. So I think what you're doing and what you're wanting to do in Oklahoma is phenomenal, and I hope you guys get it done, because you could really start this momentum shift to get rid of the property tax writ large and get rid of it in other states as well. I know Governor DeSantis has been exploring this as well. And I'm not naive to the fact that the government has to raise revenue somehow. But I think there's other ways to raise tax revenue or to bring in tax revenue to cover the core services of government without putting people's private property in jeopardy year after year. Once again, we're talking to Mike Mazie. He's running for governor in Oklahoma. The runoff is on August 25th. Talk about the role that Oklahoma can play in clamping down on illegal immigration, because states are taking more of a prominent role under Trump in addressing illegal immigration.
Yeah, when I was in the Oklahoma State Senate, we passed some landmark, first of its kind legislation to push back against illegal immigration. And then, of course, Biden opened the borders and we just had a wave of illegal immigration, create imbalances in our economy, depress wages for hardworking Oklahomans. Our sheriffs, mostly across all Oklahoma 77 counties, have been working very well with President Trump's Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the Department of Homeland Security to do what is necessary to deport illegals. Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen is from Oklahoma, and he and I have discussed the progress. So far, he tells me that they have now, in the Trump administration, deported 1 million illegal immigrants. And in a Mazie administration, we're going to, you know, work side by side, hand in hand with the president's leadership of ICE to deal with the immigration problem. We've had an additional problem in Oklahoma because of that, in terms of Chinese money and Mexican cartel drug interests invade our country because of a marijuana grow farm mess. So I've got some executive orders in place to, in Trump-like fashion, put the kibosh on that my first day in office.
Hmm. Absolutely. Once again, we're talking to Mike Mazie, running for Oklahoma governor. Mike, tell us when the election is. Explain that it is a runoff between you and another individual, but give us a little backgrounder on the upcoming date, and if there's any early voting or anything like that, the information that folks in Oklahoma should know.
Tuesday, August 25th is the runoff between myself and my opponent. Absentee ballots have already started. Early voting will begin at each county election board the Thursday before Tuesday, August 25th. We're quite excited and optimistic about our potential results, because I've been endorsed by President Donald Trump as the true conservative in this race. The Mazie plan aligns real well with the Trump agenda. So that's why President Trump endorsed us. He's called my opponent Republican in name only for a variety of reasons. So we're going to work real hard into Election Day to keep earning everyone's support, and hopefully have a really good day, or look forward to a really good day on August 25th to become the official Republican nominee for governor in the state of Oklahoma.
You know, the last thing I'll say, Mike, is that Oklahoma has been, for the most part, a solid, reliably conservative state in recent years. President Trump, multiple times, all three times, has won all the counties in Oklahoma. And so keeping that momentum going is a big deal, and it implicates and affects the momentum, the conservative momentum around the country. So that's why this election, one of many reasons this is important for Oklahoma, is to keep that conservative momentum going. The last thing I'll ask you about, and then we'll let you go, is the topic of education. Ryan Walters did a pretty good job in Oklahoma, was very out front on making sure parents are first and we protect our children and we're focused on education and not indoctrination. But as governor, talk about maybe some of the things you want to work on the education front.
Two big things. In Oklahoma, we have to move school board elections from these bizarre dates in the winter, Walker, to the November general election date, when the conservative parents with conservative values actually show up to vote and they can exact accountability on what they want the leadership of our 500 school districts, to be. In addition to that, I will also hire a statewide literacy director in my very first week in office to replicate the massive statewide literacy program that was so successful in Mississippi that helped them go from 50th to first in the country in reading outcomes. I've talked with their literacy director at length. We know what to do to replicate that model so we can get thousands and thousands of students reading at grade level and really empower them to have a successful step towards either a career tech path or a higher education path. We want the next generation of Oklahomans to have great skills for a great job and a great career.
Absolutely. Well, Mike, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Once again, we'll be talking to Mike Mazey from the state of Oklahoma. He's running for governor, and that election is on Tuesday, August 25th in the state of Oklahoma. It's a runoff. There'll be two candidates. One of them is Mike on the ballot on Tuesday, August 25th. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for joining us on the program, and best of luck.
Thanks, Walker, and everybody can learn more at mikeforok.com.
Excellent, excellent. Thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate it. All right, there you have it. That's Mike Mazey. He's running for governor in the state of Oklahoma. That runoff, again, is on the 25th of August on a Tuesday. And if you want to check out more about that race, along with all other races coming up this fall, you can go over to ivoterguide.com. That's our affiliate that is doing all the research on these candidates, including Mike. And so go over to ivoterguide.com, key in your address. That's the wonderful thing about iVoterGuide is we're interviewing these various candidates and these leaders around the country that are running for public office. And iVoterGuide is putting out the research on all these candidates. And so the August 25th runoff, that voter guide and those evaluations will be available on August 12th. So about 2 weeks out before the election, we'll have that information all available over at ivoterguide.com. But you can go there now and see all the candidates, including Mike's profile and more information about his campaign. Well, to continue our discussion of Anthony Fauci refusing to answer questions, let's listen to this clip. We'll see how much we can get through of this. But this is Dr. Fauci's attorney being booted out of the U.S. Senate hearing. Let's listen.
It's against the law to obstruct an investigation of Congress. There will be repercussions to your refusal to testify today. Senator Peters. You're not recognized. You're not recognized. If you are unruly, you will be removed from the proceeding. You are not recognized, and you are not recognized, sir. Sir, you are not recognized. You are not recognized. Security, we'll hold off. But you will respect these proceedings. You were told not to sit at the table. You insist on sitting at the table, and we told you you would not be recognized. You are not invited here for testimony, sir. You are being disruptive. Would you behave this way in a courtroom? No, because the judge would put you in jail. I can't do that today, but I can have you escorted from the premises. So I would say, sir, sit quietly and don't say another word. I said, sit quietly, you are not recognized. Another word and you're gone.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear what the attorney has to say.
He is not recognized by the committee or the chair. If he speaks again, he will be removed from the room. This testimony is from Anthony Fauci. This is not a game with his lawyers. He can advise. His lawyers can give him advice. He's got a half dozen here. They're all allowed to talk to him.
Yes.
All right?
Yes.
But the attorneys are not recognized. In fact, the attorney was told not to sit at the table, and he's not obeying that recommendation. There's a row behind you, sir. That's where you were told to sit, and you're not. And now you're disrupting the proceedings. And so, look, this is the way Anthony Fauci wants to be remembered, for a lawyer not listening to the rules. That's the way you want to be remembered, and that's what you're going to do. You are not recognized, sir. Security, please remove him from the room.
Well, there you have it. Beautiful. Dr. Fauci's attorney, one of his multiple attorneys, were booted out of the hearing. And look, if that's kid gloves right there. If that's all we do is boot his attorney out of the hearing, that's the least we can do. Folks, unfortunately, with Fauci being pardoned, it's very difficult to get full accountability here. All you can do is speak the truth and allow that to reflect the record that Anthony Fauci is a terrible person and made terrible recommendations and unscientific recommendations at that. And furthermore, there's evidence, tremendous evidence on the record that he knew better. He knew better. He even was quoted even before COVID talking about how we've studied lockdowns for years, for decades. We've studied lockdowns and they don't work. That's what Fauci said. And that's what the record shows. So there was also tremendous questions amongst the medical and scientific community on whether these mRNA shots even work or not and whether they're dangerous or not. All of that was on the record. Fauci had all of this information available to him going into COVID. And all of a sudden, they used COVID as this massive experiment on stuff that they knew didn't work. And people paid the price. People's lives, people died because of it. Their businesses were destroyed. Their families were torn apart. Marriages fell apart. All of this, tremendous damage because an unelected bureaucrat in Anthony Fauci thought he knew better. We'll be back in a few.
The God Who Speaks is a powerful message on the authority of Scripture and the voices of some of the most respected theologians of our day.
The most historic formula for the Christian church has been this: when the Scripture speaks, God speaks.
The God Who Speaks is a 90-minute documentary which can empower Christians to share our faith and defend the authenticity of the Bible. Available at thegodwhospeaks.org or visit stream.afa.net.
In many ways, abortion was on the ballot this past election, and there's reason for concern. There are many counties, cities, and states who have radicalized abortion, and thousands of tiny babies will continue to lose their lives every day. Which is why the Ministry of Preborn is on the front lines for at-risk babies and mothers with unplanned pregnancies. Preborn sponsors clinics positioned in the highest abortion areas in the country by providing them with resources that they need to rescue babies. Preborn continues to expand their life-affirming care. Their end-of-year goal is to equip 10 more clinics with ultrasound machines. These life-saving machines cost $15,000 each, more than most clinics can afford. When a woman meets her baby on ultrasound, she is twice as likely to choose life. And when she comes to a preborn clinic, she will also be embraced with God's love. $28 sponsors one ultrasound, and now through a match, your gift is doubled. How many babies can you save? Please donate. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 and say the keyword baby. Or you can go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us on the program on this edition. This is our last segment of the show. And as a brief reminder, we are going to Greece and Italy in the spring. So if you want to go on a spiritual heritage tour with us, look at Christian history in Europe, and we would love to have you join us either in Greece or in Italy. And we'll be doing that in March. And in Greece, we'll be doing the footsteps of Paul there, in particularly in Greece, not the entire footsteps of Paul, but particularly in Greece. And then my parents, Tim and Allison, will be touring Italy, looking at a lot of the Christian history in Italy and other historical sites as well. You can go over to tours.afa.net to check out more, tours.afa.net to check out more. Well, let me pronounce this correctly. Barbara Comtois is with us now on the program. She's from New Hampshire and running for the 7th district seat there, and is currently a state representative in New Hampshire. She's with us now. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on today.
Well, tell us, before we jump into some of the topics that you've been working on in the state of New Hampshire, which it's refreshing to have a conservative from New Hampshire on the program. tell us about your history, your background, and how you ended up serving in the state legislature.
Oh, my goodness. It was about almost 2 decades ago now. My husband and I had attended a meeting, and we saw some injustices, and he said, if I ever get elected to the state house, I'm going to fix this, the homestead license laws in New Hampshire. And I said, if you run, I'll campaign and get you elected. And so he did. And that was fixing the homestead food license in New Hampshire was one of his first things that he did back in 2010 when he became a state representative. He retired in 2016, and he said, oh, you should run. I said, nah, I'm never going to do this. But I said, you know what? Agriculture is really important, and it's part of our heritage here in New Hampshire, and somebody really needs to look out for it. And so he had served on the Environment and Agricultural Committee for 6 years, and I have now been serving on it for 10. Mm. So because our food security is really important, and how we raise and grow our food is important, and giving the citizens access to the food that they want and giving them a choice is extremely important and will make a difference in people's lives.
Yeah, and that's what
that's why I run.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we want to talk to you about. A very interesting subject that I think will be beneficial for our audience. We've got a lot of farmers out there around the country that listen to the radio show. And but House Bill 396 is something you've worked on and that the governor actually vetoed. But talk about this issue of basically, to your point, making food and meat available to the public for consumption and purchase, and all these red tape and these hurdles that you have to go through to get access to some of these foods.
Right. So in New Hampshire and across the U.S., the federal government mandates that amenable species, which is your pork, beef, goat, and lamb, if you're a farmer and you want to sell that meat in cuts or as sausage or burgers, it has to be processed. They have to be slaughtered and processed at a USDA facility. We have 4 in New Hampshire. Our farmers right now are booking appointments 1 to 2 years out before an animal is even born, just so they can have a slot. I've done study committees on this, met with the USDA. They blame it on the farmers that they don't know how to, bring out their meat so that it's, it's all log jammed at one particular time. But that's not the case, because our farmers have learned that they don't want to just sell at one time of the year. They want to make a living year round, which is extremely important. And so what this bill was trying to do, which we already do with rabbit and poultry and non-amenable species, is say, hey, if you're a farmer, you can slaughter the animal on your farm, which is actually less stressful for the animal. It's also a healthier way to do that. And in my opinion, more humane. But also, the farmer can then go to a custom meat shop and have those cuts and bring them home and sell them to the consumer in cuts. Because it doesn't make sense that a farmer can take the meat and sell you an eighth or a half or a whole pig or goat or cow, slaughter it on the farm, you as the farmer take it up to the meat shop that they want, have it processed, and then that consumer that had paid for that eighth of a cow can then take that home. It's stamped on the package, not for sale, and can take that home and put it in their freezer and then consume it when they want to. And the fact that we allow it for red deer and bison and rabbit and poultry is really a shame that we won't allow it for the amenable species. And the federal government, I know that Representative Massey was trying to get the PRIME Act through for several years. And nobody wants to, you know, there's a lot of money in these big farms. And New Hampshire, we only have 1.5 million people in our state. Who can keep track of their customers better and know where that meat is going if there's ever an issue? You know, we say that the USDA facility is going to keep track of that, but really, I mean, when I, back in January, when this bill was going through the House, there was over 3,000 pounds of burger, that hamburger, that went to six different states with E. coli, which is a very serious health issue. How do you track down 3,000 pounds of hamburger before it gets into the hands of the consumer? It's almost impossible.
So correct me if I'm wrong about how this is currently set up, whether it be state law or federal law. Currently, the amenable species you're talking about, livestock or poultry, have to go through these USDA facilities. And that's the problem, correct?
So poultry is separate than amenable species.
Okay.
So in New Hampshire, you can process poultry up to 10,000 birds a year on your farm and then sell those to a restaurant at the farmer's market without any oversight by the USDA.
Okay.
It's only the amenable species that you have to go through the USDA to do this.
Which would be your livestock, like your cattle, et cetera?
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying here. And that's, I think this is, in Mississippi, what I do personally is I buy either a half or a whole beef cow, but I pick it up from a USDA facility because I think that's how it has to go, to your point, which is the legislation you've addressed. What you're trying to do is allow farmers to sell directly to consumers. So if you're a cattle farmer, you can sell directly, you can process and sell directly to an individual instead of having to go through this federal, you know, regulated hodgepodge of entities and agencies.
Correct.
Why? I know the lobby, the meat, every industry has a lobby and they are built to protect the business interests of the conglomerates. But what's the problem here? I mean, is this sheerly a money thing where they're afraid of, you know, basically farmers bypassing the major facilities? What would you say is the main driver in, for example, the governor vetoing this?
Well, you know, in the governor's veto, I mean, she mentioned poultry in the veto message to start with, which we already can slaughter poultry already. So right there told me that she didn't understand anything about the bill. She also said that the USDA facility hasn't seen any log jams or backlogs. Well, that's not necessarily true either, because farmers are, you know, a year to 2 years in advance making their appointments. Yes. So the thing is we worked, this legislation mirrors what we did for the non-amenable species. with the exception of, as we made sure that they could only sell cuts of meat and not sell burger or anything, because we didn't want to be contamination or have any health issues. And it also limits the number of animals you can process in a month. So it can't be a huge commercial farm, so that the small farmer can actually make a living. And here in New Hampshire, with the farms that we have, and we're a huge agricultural community here, we can only feed about 6% of our population. But beef prices are going up. As we go to the grocery store, we see that where we, but you also don't know where your meat's coming from. You're not sure what it's being fed. People are interested in their health now and really paying attention to what they're eating. And it's extreme, you know, but the thing is it's also a choice. I have a friend who's a farmer. She said she's probably still going to use the USDA, but there may be some times where she would go through non-USDA. Yeah. She'd like to have the option to do both. And it's all about accessibility of the food.
Yeah. And to counter this argument, all the arguments out there about safety and regulation and blah, 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 which are really statistical anomalies in the grand scheme of things. These quote horror stories, right? Which you mentioned, there's horror stories with the USDA facilities. And to be honest, the ones I've been into are disgusting. The USDA facilities are horrendous, the ones I've been into. But nonetheless, the private sector has checks and balances to address this stuff. So if a private farmer who is slaughtering and processing cattle to sell to their neighbors and their friends, you know, has some kind of outbreak of something, there's private civil ways to address claims without having to go through the federal government. And so this notion that it's going to be the Wild West and completely unregulated and, you know, a safety disaster is just totally discounting all of the checks and balances that are in place from a state and local level without having to go through the feds.
Right. Well, we had to have a USDA facility here in New Hampshire shut down because of bad practices, where they weren't having enough airflow in their freezer. People were losing an additional 20% of the meat because of the airflow and what had to be cut off before it could be processed. You know, and there's some other major issues with that particular facility. But you, as a farmer, you are reliant on goodwill from people.
Correct.
One bad review and you're done.
Yes.
So to say, but the USDA facilities, one bad review or, you know, an outbreak of five, you know, at one point there was 4.0 million pounds of a major brand out there with a high health threat hazard. It doesn't affect that. You know, that brand, and it doesn't affect anybody, and nobody really knows it's happening.
Yes.
Because unless you go on to the USDA site on a daily or weekly basis, you do not know what's in recall.
Yeah. And
what's happening.
Not to mention all the junk they're putting in our beef. I mean, all this water and excess fat. I mean, this straw man that all of a sudden, if the federal government puts their stamp on it, then it's spotless, it's perfect, it's clean, is just the biggest hoax around. And I think small farms, locally owned farms running this direct to consumer is not a problem. And it's definitely not any more of a problem than the current system we got with the USDA processing facilities. At a minimum, it's a net break even as far as risk versus reward at a minimum. But to your point, there are strong cases that favor the local farmers. Once again, we've been talking to Barbara Comtois from New Hampshire. She's representing the 7th District and has been working on this food issue in New Hampshire for a long time, sponsored legislation, et cetera. And we appreciate you, Ms. Barbara, coming on the program.
Well, thank you very much. I really am happy to be here. And this is such an important topic for people. And I think if we can get this passed here, then it will open up the pathway for other states maybe to follow. You know, someone has to do it and someone has to be first, because we can't rely on the federal government to get this done and, you know, give us the healthiest food possible.
Absolutely. Hey, thanks so much, Ms. Barber, for coming on the program, and hopefully we'll talk to you again sometime soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Absolutely. The legislation, by the way, that we were talking about is House Bill 396 in New Hampshire that was previously vetoed by the governor, just so you guys can look that up and read about it, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But this is an issue that really multiple states have been working on, trying to open up the market for these small family-owned farms to be able to go direct to consumer on some of this meat processing. And look, the fact that we are even having to debate the federal government's role in family-owned farms selling meat to friends and family and community members is just, if our founding fathers knew that the feds had their hand in this, they would be extremely upset. Because that's just not the role of the federal government to be meddling around in state and local business affairs in this regard. And I understand the health, safety, and well-being arguments, but this just isn't a problem. It's not a problem having small farms sell direct to consumer. It's just not a problem. And that's just the way that it is. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.